Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I talked to the creator of the new Star Wars series, The Acolyte, Leslie Headland, about how she wanted to make a show that mixed Kill Bill with Frozen. New cinema releases this week include the return of Inside Out and the new Nicolas Cage apocalypse horror, Arcadian. Plus, the co-directors of Netflix's new animated film, Ultraman Rising, chat about how it's really a movie all about sleepless parents. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. We had no show last week due to the election. And what an election it was. Don't worry, we're not going to discuss politics on this show. This is apolitical, this show, as much as anything can ever be apolitical. There are much better places on this station to hear about politics than what you'd hear from me. But I just, the length of it, you know, I was in a count centre in 2011 in the Wicklow count centre for News Talk. And I was there for 3 days. And by the end of it, it's like you're in a hospital ward. And, you know, that strange feeling, if you've maybe ever been in hospital and you're in this place, it feels like you can never leave. That's what those count centres are like. So without any stripe or any political allegiance, I do feel terribly sorry for all the people involved in those counts, particularly for the ones that went on that long, because it's a really strange feeling to be stuck in that place. But as I say, this is an apolitical show. You're here for movies and TV and the wry musings I can give you on such things. There was no show last week, but lots of people were still in touch about a couple of things we were talking about the previous week, most notably Hitman on Netflix, the new Richard Linklater movie all about a fake hitman. People are really enjoying it. That's getting great reviews, and rightly so. And also Eric, which also happens to be on Netflix, the great Benedict Cumberbatch in a great series about a missing child and a puppet who comes to life. And I think people maybe misunderstood what that show was going to be from those trailers, because it does involve Benedict Cumberbatch talking to a giant-sized puppet that's from his imagination. But the show is so much more than that. It's all about New York in the 80s and a marriage breakup and a missing child. And people are loving that because it is a great kind of whodunit and emotional drama as well. So if you're a casual listener to this show, which is fine, you know, come whenever you want. But Eric on Netflix is a great watch, and people are telling me they're really enjoying it. So that's a continuing recommendation for me of on Netflix, which is Eric, and also Hitman, which is a great watch as well. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
Yes, my child.
We have unfinished business. Attack me with all your strength.
I appreciate your courage, young warrior. I have no quarrel with you.
Attack me, Jedi.
Jedi do not attack the unarmed.
Yes, you do.
Now, Jedis, it can only mean one thing. Yes, Star Wars. It's back. Well, the latest TV version of it in the franchise. That is a clip from The Acolyte. Now, this is the new Disney Plus Star Wars series. Now, this is taking place in the Star Wars universe, probably during the final days of the good times. And I won't, if you're not into Star Wars, I don't want to lose you with, the mythology. But let's just say this is taking place at the end of the good old days, before evil comes to the shores of the universe. And what's, I suppose, slightly different about this is it's a kind of whodunit in the Star Wars universe, a murder mystery of sorts. So it begins with an assassin, a young woman named May, played by Amanda Stenberg, and she's coming to kill a Jedi master. And the big twist here, and it's not hard to see coming, and it's not really spoiler territory, because this is in the promos for it, is that Stenberg plays May, that's the mysterious young woman, her twin sister, Osha, who we discovered was once a Jedi. And Amanda Stenberg plays both sisters. So May has been presumed dead for 16 years after an incident in her homeland involving the family and the Jedi Order, in which things went very badly. But she's mysteriously back on the scene looking to kill Jedis. Now, we don't know what exactly happened. That's one of the mysteries, and why she's so out to kill Jedis and why her and her sister are no longer together. We also have as one of the Jedi Masters, Lee Jung-jae, who was the star of Squid Game, and he's front and centre in this. And then May's character brushes up against a guy called Kumir. He's an ally of May's, and he's kind of a drifter who has no cares at all, and he's a former smuggler who's, you know, making his living as a somewhat dubious trader. And he evolves into kind of the Han Solo character in this series. He's played by Manny Jacinto, who people will know was one of the leads in the great series The Good Place, which people absolutely love, which was a big hit in lockdown. This was created by Leslie Headland. She previously gave us the great TV show Russian Doll. So she's been given the keys to this new iteration of Star Wars. And she wanted this to be a version of something along the lines of a mix between Frozen and Kill Bill, which is an interesting way of putting it, because it is a kind of murder mystery. It is, there's plenty of action and killing in it, but it is a sisterly story as well. And it works. There have been hits and misses in the Star Wars canon since Disney took over. The first season of The Mandalorian, I thought, was brilliant. Obi-Wan, not so good. Andor was great. This is decent. It really is. And I like the way it has two sisters at its core. And it's attempting to do something slightly different. And it is doing great numbers on Disney Plus at the moment. So anyway, I got to talk to its creator, Leslie Headland, and also one of its stars, Manny Jacinto. Have a listen to this. Hello, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic.
Wonderful. We're off to a great start. The three of us are all in good moods.
Yes.
Leslie, if I can start with you, you know,
please.
The second movie I ever saw, or film as we call it in this part of the world, because I'm in Dublin, Ireland, was The Empire Strikes Back. And this series has been deep with me all my life. And I read something very similar about you, and you described it as it being almost cellular. The whole Star Wars thing, that, you know, It's just a big part of your life, which is lovely that they've given it to someone who's such a fan of it. When you were told that you were coming into the tent of Star Wars, is it trepidation or joy or a bit of both?
Initially, it was absolute joy. Yeah, it was just, walking, you know, I didn't know what walking was. I didn't know what sitting was. Like, it just felt so surreal. I couldn't believe it was happening. And then it became scary, because then it became real. It was like you're sitting at a different lunch table. Like, that's what it felt like. You're just you're just in a different place. And I felt that I needed to give everything I had, and I had to give my whole life over. I had to give all of my energy, everything that I could possibly give to it. Now it's coming out, and there's so much pressure, and it's odd and terrifying to let it go. It's been the structure of my life for so long that I actually don't know what's going to happen to me.
Wow. Yeah, I do. I think I do. Yeah. Well, you were clearly very committed to it. Manny, I watched four of the episodes and I thought I was very clever in that I was going to say to you that I think you're this series is Han Solo. But then I realized you've made that point 1,000 times already. So I feel kind of stupid. But can you just tell me, like I haven't heard that before, why you think he's the Han Solo of this series?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the great part of Han Solo is that he's like a man of the people. Like, he's that guy. I don't know if Chimer is that guy, but I mean, he wants to be. He wishes he was Han Solo. I always pitch a Han Solo Chimer spinoff. I don't know if that's physically possible, but yeah. I mean, it's the fun aspect of a character that isn't Sith or Jedi is that you get to figure out just as how a civilian deals with these larger powers. And luckily, Leslie wanted a civilian that was, you know, kind of a bit of a goofball and just didn't really take things seriously. I think it just makes for some really great scenes.
A reluctant kind of hero, maybe, you know, but I don't want to go near spoiler territory, which one has to be very careful about in the Star Wars universe. But again, Leslie, you said this great thing that you wanted to make Frozen with a touch of Kill Bill, right? Which I think is a great way of putting it and might be a good advertisement for it. But explain that to our listeners, if you would.
Well, it's funny because when I started my pitch to Kathleen, I was like, it's Kill Bill meets Frozen. And she was like, what? You know, she said, is there a snowman?
We've got the wrong person.
Yeah, she was like, but as I went through it, she was like, oh, got it. Like she warmed up to it immediately. Like once she realized it was about these two sisters and it was about them being on opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, an easy way to put it is one of them is light side, one of them is dark side. I don't think it's that. I don't think that the sides of the force is that simple. But they're out of balance. They have to reconnect with each other. And I was really affected by Frozen when I saw it in the theater. This might sound kind of cheesy, but I cried and I thought, you know, my life, if I'd seen this when I was younger, my life would have been totally different. So I really wanted to tell a story like that. I mean, obviously it's darker and it's got that Kill Bill element to it that makes it, you know, not a cartoon.
I have a daughter and for about a year, she watched Frozen every day. I'm not joking. Yes. Those things matter a lot. Manny, just in closing, I want to say, I loved you in Happy Place. The Good Place. I was thinking it was my Happy Place. Why do you think that show has been as popular as it has? And in the 30 seconds we have left, it's loved and it's kind of universally loved.
Yeah, I'm just as surprised as you are. I think it also came during a time when people were watching it and, you know, during the pandemic when people had a good amount of hope. And it's just a wholesome show that provides a lot of hope for people, you know, especially in that, like when things end, you know, how do you cope with things? And I think it was very much just a coping mechanism for a lot of people. And it was a show, hopefully like ours, that can be shared with.
Just to bring it back.
Yes, like with, like you said, like your daughter, like you can share it with your dad, your grandfather.
Sure.
It appeals to so many people. And it's hopefully it can bring people together.
It's one of those rare series too that that nails the ending. Lands the ending. It was astonishing.
Well, we're out of time, Leslie, but in very Irish fashion, I have lots of children and I watched The Acolyte with my eldest son, who's really enjoying it so far. And he's 11. Good. So that'll be good for you to hear.
Good. Yeah. Oh, nice. I think that's the age too.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the age where they're old enough to kind of.
Yeah. Or you can be 48 either as well. That was the point where you meant to go, you don't look 48. But anyway, I think I'm out of time. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye. Thanks. Leslie Headland there, the creator of The Acolyte and Disney Plus, and one of its stars, Manny Jacinto there, talking to me about making Star Wars, The Acolyte. Now, it's dropping. There was two last Tuesday they dropped. Now, there's going to be 8 episodes. One is dropping every week, every Tuesday, I believe it is. And if you're a Star Wars fan, this will keep you entertained, and people are very much enjoying it. So that's The Acolyte on Disney Plus. Up next, the week's new cinema releases, which include the return of Inside Out in the imaginatively titled Inside Out 2. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and chief among them this week is Inside Out 2. Yes, they made a sequel to the beloved Pixar movie from a good few years ago. And also the return of Nicolas Cage, not that he ever went away, in a, I was going to say horror, let's get into it in a while. It's called Arcadian, and I have seen it. More importantly, freelance writer and journalist and arts critic and all sorts of things, Neve O'Reilly joins me in studio. How many monikers can fit in my father's mansion? Yeah. Okay, you're well?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Someone texted in someone saying there's nothing as boring as people on radio asking each other how they are.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's a nice, humanizing thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're well. Now, are you well having seen Inside Out 2? So this was a beloved movie. I remember being in the screening. I haven't seen this one. And just, I remember being there going, my God, that was good. Remind people, if you would, just briefly, top line, what happened in the first Inside Out?
So amazingly, this was 2015.
Wow.
Which
is 9 years ago.
No, it doesn't seem like that long time.
Tempus fugit.
I know. So it basically followed this little 11-year-old girl called Riley, and she was making a big move from Minnesota to San Francisco, and it basically followed that upheaval in her life and trying to fit in. But it was not just about her life on the outside, but inside, and how her emotions kind of ruled her life. So this one picks up when...
And those emotions, though, were humanized. They characters.
They were humanized. So I don't know if people of our age might remember the numbskulls in the Beano.
Yeah.
It was a little bit like that, but obviously a lot more Pixar polished.
Yes.
So these little kind of humanized emotions controlling her from a center in her brain with like a big panel in front of them and buttons and stuff like that. So it was quite fun. So this picks up when Riley has turned 13.
I'm sorry, I'm going to let you get to that. But do you share my approbation of the first one? I thought it was lovely.
It was, I mean, I think it's up there with one of Pixar's best.
Yeah.
It's up there for me with Up. Yeah. The likes of Up and WALL-E, just in terms of how it hits.
Yeah, huge emotional punch.
Yeah, and they have had a few patchy ones, you know, recently. So this, it was nice to see them revisit this.
Because now you can talk about Inside Out 2.
So she's 13, has become a teenager. So you might remember, if you've seen the first one, there was a button put in on the console in her brain that said puberty. And it was only very quickly alluded to. And they were like, that probably won't be important. We'll just move on. Oh, it is important. So she's a teenager in this. The puberty alarm has gone off, which signals lots of changes in Riley's life. But Joy is back, voiced by Amy Poehler. And at the start of the film, she gives us a little catch up. Riley's doing really well. She's made some friends. She's settled into San Francisco. She's finished middle school and will be starting high school very soon. So all is well. until Riley gets the news that her two friends that she's made won't be joining her in the same high school. So that's kind of a big deal for her. So she has kind of a dilemma, I guess, moving forward. Does she kind of leave those friends behind, try and make new friends? What does she do there? On the inside, what is happening is puberty. So that means a whole range of new emotions basically bulldoze their way in. Chief among them is anxiety, voiced by Maya Hawke. And I think we can all relate to that flush of anxiety. There's also embarrassment, there's envy, and a brilliant one called ennui, which I can only really describe as, if you think of your typical bored, disinterested teenager, that's what ennui kind of represents.
Right, so it's very similar to the first one, except with a whole slew of new emotions.
Yeah, I suppose that's the one sort of thing I wasn't so impressed with. It did kind of feel in some ways like a rerun of the first one, just with different emotions kind of in place of it. And Joy in particular on the inside has to learn that not everything can be great all the time. And what they are focused on this time around, now that Riley's a little bit older, is her sense of self. So that has a very... a vivid representation in her mind as a tree.
Okay.
And it's made up of all her emotions and her experiences. And Joy is very much in control of those once again. And she's tightly controlling what sort of emotions are making Riley's sense of self. So at the beginning of the film, Riley's sense of self is just completely, I am a good person, and that's it. So it's very one dimensional. So over the course of the film, Joy has to learn to let the other emotions in, even anxiety, which a lot of us don't like, but it is an actually important part of us. And in order to have, I suppose, a fully rounded sense of self, you've got to let the so-called bad emotions in there. So that's what's going on the inside. And
is there an emotion representing possibly falling in love with boys and stuff like that?
No, not yet. But I would say they are going to maybe make a
in
third
the third,
one,
fourth, fifth, and
you
sixth
get the
one.
Feeling. I don't know if you remember a documentary called Seven Up, where they kept checking in on children.
I don't know.
Whether it's still running. They're probably well grown up.
Some of them have died, but my understanding is it's still in motion. Yeah.
You feel like Inside Out could be something like that.
Yeah,
they could pick up with Riley well into her teenage years. You know?
Okay, they could do that, but should they do that based on Inside Out 2? Did you like this one?
I did like it. It hits differently. It doesn't have as much of an impact as the first one. The first one was so unique and so inventive and so creative. Mm. We've seen it all before and they haven't really done anything different this time around. But I think for the adults in the room, there's a lot here. I mean, there's Joy starts talking about, you know, she has this realization that maybe as you grow up, you just need joy less in your life, which I thought was really sad.
Yeah.
So it does kind of hit, I think, the adults on one level, maybe harder than the kids. I enjoyed it. I think they could have done something a little bit different with it. And I'd like to see them maybe go off in a different direction if they do a third one, because it's just more of the same. Do you know
right.
what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's such a wonderful idea that you wonder, where do you go with it, you know?
In this one, they just had a brief moment of Riley and her two friends in a car, and they had, obviously, Riley's emotions inside out, and they were sort of looking at her friend, and she did a frown, and they were both, the emotions in one another's brains were overanalyzing the frown and what it meant, and it was nice to see that very sort of teenage experience of overanalyzing what you think someone else thinks of you. So I think they could maybe go down that route a little bit more and look at maybe what other characters are thinking inside sort of their brain and not just Riley.
Or
that would expand it a little bit out.
They could just stop making Inside Out movies because they made a great one. That's an option too.
I would say the Disney or the Pixar bigwigs are like cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
So what are you going to say stars-wise for Inside Out 2?
I would say a very strong three.
A very strong three. Yeah. Okay, I thought you were going to say a modest three.
No, I really did enjoy it. Okay. I know my seven-year-old is going to love it.
Right.
So I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, okay. Let's take a quick clip of Inside Out 2.
I'm Anxiety. I'm one of Riley's new emotions, and we are just super jazzed to be here. Where can I put my stuff?
What do you mean, we?
Oh, I wish I was as tall as all of you.
Who the heck are you?
I'm Envy.
Oh, look at your hair.
Oh, yeah, not happening.
Okay, who's this guy?
What's your name, big fella?
That's embarrassment. He's not really big on eye contact or, good talking, but he's a really sweet guy.
Well, welcome to headquarters, embarrassment. Oh, we're doing a fit. No. Oh, nope. Going high. Oh, you got a real sweaty palm there, buddy.
What emotion was that?
That's Ennui.
On what?
Ennui. It's what you would call the boredom.
Well, come on up here. Ennui. Am I saying right? And why? No. Oh, nicknames. I'm going to call you Wee Wee.
No.
That's a clip of Inside Out 2, which is in cinemas from this Friday, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the 14th of June, said he, looking at his watch, which has a calendar on it.
Nice.
Swanky, eh? So.
Mine's a boring old one.
We're going to the new Nicolas Cage movie. I said in the intro horror, and then I stopped myself because it's more a post-apocalyptic drama with maybe some horror elements. What's going on in Arcadia?
I think it wants to be a horror, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. I should say this was shot almost exclusively, I think, in Ireland.
It looks like it.
Kilpeder in Ashford and in Ardmore Studios in Bray, which is where I live. So
excellent.
Go on, Bray.
Okay.
Yeah, go. you're right. This is a post-apocalyptic sort of thriller, I suppose, for want of a better word, that stars Nicolas Cage as Paul. And at the start of the film, we see him kind of fleeing, I suppose, a war and a cataclysmic event that has sort of caused the end of the world, we can only assume. And he's running down what looks like a lane in Bray, I have to say. But anyway, you have to suspend your disbelief here.
You're not making some comparison between Bray and a post-apocalyptic landscape.
I recognise the location.
Okay.
But anyway, he stumbles upon these two infant babies and we're sort of wondering, what's he going to do? Anyway, it flashes forward 15 years and he has adopted these two baby boys who have grown into strapping young teenagers. And they're living quite happily in a sort of remote farmhouse, surviving, but surviving well. They're able to grow their own food. You know, they don't look in bad shape. Nicolas Cage doesn't seem to age in the 15 years that has passed. But anyway, and all is well, apart from when nighttime comes and they all have to rush into the house, barricade the doors, the windows, and something is out there in the darkness, scratching at the doors, banging to get in. We don't know what it is, but it's a big, bad, nasty. And that's, I suppose, the basics.
I have seen this, and I would counter slightly in that you say all is well, but they don't seem terribly happy in the house. They're surviving, but the two brothers, the two sons, are kind of giving out to each other a lot.
Yeah, I suppose all is well in terms of the world is over.
Yeah.
But like they are doing okay, as opposed to maybe some, you know, how they could be.
Given their limited horizons, they're probably doing okay.
Yeah. And there's definitely shades of 28 Weeks Later in this and A Quiet Place. It's not as good as either of those films.
No.
But it definitely has taken influences from them. But you're right, the two boys are kind of at odds. I think they're very different personalities. Mm. Joseph is sort of more interested in, I suppose, sticking with Nicolas Cage, the dad, and surviving. Mm-hmm. Whereas Thomas keeps going off to the neighbour's farm.
Yeah.
Now, when I say neighbours, it's a good trek away.
It sure is.
And he has struck up a relationship with the girl who lives there, Charlotte. So there's a little bit of tension there. Nicolas Cage isn't too happy about that.
Yeah.
These unnamed sort of creatures that live in the darkness, they're kind of at a standoff with them, really, until something happens.
Yes.
And I won't say what it is, but things take a turn.
Yeah, they do. Now, I'm wondering what you thought, because, you know, Nicolas Cage, love him, loathe him, you know, a unique presence in cinema. Sometimes you're like, wow, Nicolas Cage in post-apocalyptic horror. It's almost like a cliche or something. Yeah. But this was okay, I thought. Yeah. It held my attention for its 94 minutes, which is quite short.
Too. And I think partly that's because I think Nicolas Cage is a supporting actor in this. He's sort of a weird footnote in it. I mean, I don't know about you, John, but I didn't have Nicolas Cage smoking a cigar in front of Powers Court Waterfall on my bingo card for 2024.
No, I certainly
not. But it is in this film. But he does take a back seat and he lets the three young leads kind of take over here. And I think when they're together on screen, it works really well. And this does work as a creature film in parts. I think it works best when you don't see the creature, to be perfectly honest with you. And there's one scene in particular with Joseph, and he's in the house by himself and one of the creatures is at the door, and it's really menacing. There's a lot of tension. It's a slow build. The scene seems to last for ages. You don't know what's going to happen, and unfortunately it doesn't keep that up over the rest of the film. And once you see the creature, it kind of loses its appeal, because the creature is not scary. I don't think they knew what to make of it. It has the face of a horse. It has the body of a spider. It has humanoid fingers. It has a xenomorph mouth. It has everything and anything thrown at it, and it is not scary.
Yeah, it doesn't work when you see it, but you're right. The kind of Jaws effect when
so
it's
so much better.
Presence is hinted at.
Film,
yeah.
And even up into the middle, you don't fully see this thing, and it's much scarier when you don't know what it is and you can't see it.
Yeah.
But once you do, it takes a bit of time.
Yeah, when you put it like that, I see what you're saying. But that said, I did want to see where it went and everything. And it is, mercifully or not, 94 minutes.
Yeah.
So stars-wise, what would you say for Arcadian?
This is going to sound harsh. I'm going to say 2. But
okay.
I think it just, for some technical things and the story, you know, I don't think the script was quite there. And, you know, the creature just wasn't up to it. I was on here a couple of weeks ago reviewing Atlas. I gave that 2. If you were asking me to, you know, which one would I watch? I'd watch Arcadian of the two star films. So it's a strong 2, if that's
I think I'd go along with you. I was going to say, are we 3? But it's not quite 3.
No,
because,
but it does make Ireland look beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a really, it looks gorgeous. It was obviously shot in the winter, the autumn. Beautiful. So
I have no memory of him being here or hearing about it whatsoever. So that's 2 for Arcadia from Nevo Roy. I would give it 2 as well. A strong 2.
Yeah.
It's not terrible. Not that that's a ringing endorsement. By the way, talking of Nicolas Cage, about 3 years ago, right in the eye of lockdown, a movie came out, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, The Burden of Massive...
The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
It came out of nowhere.
And not enough people have seen that.
If you haven't seen it, I think it's on Prime.
Yeah.
It's so fantastic. And also Pedro Pascal is in it.
Yeah.
The women out there who love Pedro Pascal, you will enjoy it from that point of view too.
But Nick Cage sends himself up so brilliantly.
And I think very willingly.
Yeah.
I think it came from a loving sort of place. It wasn't really, you know, nastily taking the piss out of him. It was like he was a lot in with the joke, and it was great.
It was absolutely brilliant. So watch that, I would suggest, first and foremost ahead of Arcadian. But Arcadian is in cinemas, also is Inside Out 2. We gave Inside Out 2 a strong 3. We're giving Arcadian a strong 2. I have to be careful. This is a new criteria, strong and weak stars.
I'm ripping up the rule book here.
Niamh O'Reilly, thank you very much. Niamh O'Reilly there chatting to me about the week's new movie releases. Up next, the co-directors of the new animated movie on Netflix, Ultraman Rising. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Now take a listen to this.
She is not a thing, Ken. And we've never seen an infant kaiju. In fact, no one has.
Great. Super helpful. Yeah, I think I'd be better off asking Siri.
Ken, I'm not the one who brought a giant baby kaiju home.
We have to figure something out.
Oh,
great. why is she changing colors?
Maybe you should ask Siri.
Do not start, Mina.
If I were to guess, Ken, I'd say she has imprinted on you.
No. Are you saying...
Yes, Ken, she thinks you... are her mother.
I am not built for this. I've got a life, a title to win. Ugh. You do something nice, and now I'm babysitting a giant pink lizard thing.
What on earth was that? That was a clip from Ultraman Rising, the new Netflix movie, children's movie, I suppose you'd say, animated film, all about Ultraman. Now, Ultraman was and is a massive superhero character in Eastern culture in Japan and on all parts of Asia, who I distantly heard of. In this movie, Ultraman Rising, they're taking up the mantle. This is probably the most mainstream iteration of Ultraman so far. We have in this movie Tokyo under siege from a rising monster attack, and a young baseball star called Ken Sato reluctantly returns home and takes on the mantle of Ultraman, which has been in his family. But the titanic superhero meets his match when he's forced to adopt a 35-foot fire-breathing baby dragon, or a baby kaiju. Now, kaiju are these giant monsters of Japanese popular culture, of which Godzilla is probably the most famous, certainly in the West. Now, Sato, that's Ken Sato, the baseball star, now Ultraman, must rise above his ego to balance his job as a superhero and baseball star and parenthood while protecting the baby. The baby's called Emmy, by the way, from forces bent on exploiting her for their own dark plans. Now, this Ultraman Rising is from Netflix and also from Industrial Light and Magic, those people who've gave us some of the greatest special effects of all time. It was co-written and directed by a man called Shannon Tindall, and also co-directed by John Oshima. Shannon Tindall previously gave us Lost Ollie, that animated series. This is a really good kids' watch. My five-year-old loved it. As I told Shannon and John when I spoke to them earlier in the week, nice to see you guys. And I watched this with my five-year-old, who gave it a big thumbs up. You'll be pleased to hear.
That's great to hear.
And talking of children, Shannon, if I can start with you, I read that you kind of weaponized sleeplessness when you became a new father as the genesis for this story, which I like. And believe me, I get, because I have three children and I've had many sleepless nights on account of them. But tell me about how that process worked its way into the script.
So, you know, I initially developed the idea before I had a child. So I was approaching it from the perspective of being a child and a relationship with my parents. Then when my daughter was born, then it became very much, okay, this is what this is like. And they don't, as you know, they don't come with instructions. Nobody's an expert on them. No matter what they say, nobody's an expert on kids. You can't figure them out because every kid's different. But I was desperate, and I was calling my mom and dad. And like, what do I do? I can't figure it out. And I thought there would be incredible empathy to be expressed in the story, but also incredible fun. So as you said, and I've said, I weaponize those things. So it, you know, if they're crying in the middle of the night, the direction that I gave Randy Tom, our amazing sound designer who created Emmy's voice, I said, I want that cry that we hear, that sonic cry. It needs to feel like what it feels when a baby is crying on a plane. And that that actually happened, by the way, the flight over last night. Oh, no. There's a little baby that had this insane, and it's, you know, 1 a.m. and just this piercing cry going through the whole cabin. And, you know, it just, it's like, you know, nails on a chalkboard. And but you still have empathy, too, because you've been there. You've been there. You know what that feels like. You're trying to calm them down and you can't. They won't. But in Emmy's case, she can destroy millions of dollars worth of sports cars.
Yeah. If I can ask you, you know, I know a bit about superheroes. I grew up with them, with my Batman and Superman and Hulk and all that. But Ultraman never made it to me anyway. And I don't think in Ireland, where I'm talking to you from, like, is Ultraman a big superhero? I mean, you made a movie about him, so I guess you think he is, but did he lie heavy in your comic book consciousness and your friends when you were growing up?
Oh, I mean, I was born in Japan, and so yeah, Ultraman franchise has been already a household staple. You know, it's a multi-generational hero, and it's in the Japanese psyche at this point. It's a huge,
and not just Japan, it's China, Malaysia, Indonesia, yeah. Singapore, everywhere.
And so I'm a kid, you know, I was born in the late 70s, so I'm a kid of the 80s, and of course Ultraman was already everywhere. My first discovery was picking up a manga called Dr. Slump by Akira Toriyama, who also created Dragon Ball. And in Dr. Slump, he had this character that was fascinated with Ultraman and wanted to be Ultraman. And so, like, even the manga artist was obviously fascinated in order to put that into his comic, right? And so it's just, like, built into its culture, pulp culture influences. And so for me, you know, growing up watching the show and you know, so I know the legacy, the weight behind this property, and never thought that I would ever even have a chance to work with this hero in the U.S. And once I moved to the U.S. when I was 8, I completely had forgotten about it because it wasn't really around. It wasn't really available. And it came back on my radar once I met Shannon at Cal Arts, and he starts talking about all his love for Japanese pulp culture. So that's why we became fast friends. And you know, he shows me the sketch of an idea that is inspired by Ultraman, and it has this baby kaiju in it. And that baby kaiju has been the same since. And so now that I'm, you know, here and was had the opportunity and the honor of working with this, like, superhero, it's a dream.
Yeah. Now, I didn't unfortunately have time to do my research on the character of Ultraman, but was he, and not to go down a superhero cultural appropriation rabbit hole or anything, but does he predate Superman or does he come after? Because I was thinking of the similarities, Superman.
He's after Superman, but a very different character.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
And he came out around the same time as Marvel when they transitioned from Timely to Marvel, which I think was 1963 with Fantastic Four. But that character in Asia, most of Asia is bigger than Superman is in the rest of the world, or Spider-Man, or any of those characters. It's really remarkable.
It's definitely its first. Probably, you know, Japan and Asia's like first superhero.
But our, you know, our number one job was let's tell an Ultraman story that feels like it belongs in the long line of Ultraman stories, but that there's no barrier to entry for people who don't know anything.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. It's just a good story, whether you know who he is or not. Tell me this, the animation is lovely in it. And in Ireland, we have a very successful animation studio called Cartoon Saloon.
I was just hanging with Tom and Nora in March.
There you go.
I always go out to hang with them when I'm into, and we showed them the film. They were the first studio to see the film outside of Netflix.
Wow. High praise indeed. And you know, Tom said this, because I know him a bit over the years through this job. Tom said this great thing to me once about, you know, hand-drawn animation and its importance. And they specialize in that. And then I was, and this sounds like terrible name dropping, but I was talking to Pete Docter a couple of years ago. And I said to him, I suppose I was almost saying to him, you know, your cartoons are great, but here in Ireland, we hand-draw them. And he said, well, hang on a second. No matter what, you know, computer magic we use, it begins with someone sitting there going, let's do this. I presume you guys kind of concur in that. I'm sure you use all sorts of high tech stuff, but it probably begins with someone taking up a pen or a marker or a pencil in their hand.
Well, the first drawings of Ken Sato and Emmy were done with pencil and marker. What I used to do is I would take the pencil drawing and copy it onto a specific kind of paper that would take marker well, and then I would marker it. It's actually, that drawing is going to be, that I did in 2001, is going to be in the art and making of book that we've just done. And I'm constantly drawing. I'm always, and it's the shorthand idea. Even when I was doing the series a couple of years ago, Lost to Ollie, in the writer's room, there were many times, you know, when you're in a writer's room, you're penning up, you're writing ideas on index cards and you're putting it up on the board. But there were times when people in the room would be like, well, I don't know how to write this. And I would just sketch it because that's what I'm used to and pin that up. And be like, yes, like that. So people have been communicating that way for tens of thousands of years. So it's just a natural shorthand. So he's 100% right. There's still drawing involved. I was drawing Emmy on the flight over. So it's that's how you communicate a shot. This guy draws some of the best, clearest, fastest thumbnails. Like, we'll be in meetings and he'll just crank out like something like that. I'm like, exactly like that. Let's do that.
Yeah. It's a visual narrative, you know, what we do.
Yeah.
So, it is a quicker way of communicating that, and because that's what, you know, ultimately, is what we want on screen, if it visually communicates without any words or being said. And so, and even the animation notes and annotations that we do, it requires a hand-drawn approach.
Well, we actually did hand-drawn animation in this film. Tony Facilli, one of our animation supervisors, Ken's approach to the play. Tony is a huge baseball fan. His dad played professional ball. And we asked him to hand draw the test. So he did this beautiful hand drawn test that I'm sure we'll show at some point, but it's so we still have hand drawn animation still being done to inform the CG process.
Absolutely. The pencil is king. All the other stuff comes in. Yes. Well, listen, the movie's great. You guys still seem like friends, which is great to see, despite being on treadmills of publicity and selling movies and stuff like that. So nice to talk to you, and continued success.
Awesome. Thanks so much, John. Appreciate it.
Shannon Tindall and John Oshima talking to me there about Ultraman Rising, which is on Netflix from this Friday. That's the 14th of June. It's one for the family, one for the small kids in your life. A great action superhero movie with lovely animation, which you'll enjoy, about a superhero that you may never have heard of, or very loosely heard of. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Do get in touch with me at any stage. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, and of course you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. We'll do it all again next week. In closing though, I just want to say goodbye and thank you. I'm not going anywhere, but a man who is going anywhere is a man called Lachlan Hart, who was in charge of basically imaging here on News Talk. And from my point of view, for the last numerous years, organized all the kind of audio promotions for this show you ever might have heard, and also rescued lost interviews for me, and did all sorts of audio genius stuff for Screen Time. over the years. He was great at what he did. He was and is, continues to be, whatever he does in the future. And he was just one of the nicest guys you could ever deal with. So I want to say a massive thank you and a heartfelt goodbye to Lachlan Hart. Thank you all for listening, and I will talk to you all next week.